Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is the, technically the sixth official Hacker Public Radio Roundtable, although the fifth lost to the lack of talk show recording, or not recording it. So we've actually switched over to a cool little site called talk.fedoraproject.org, which is brought to us by the Fedora Project. thank you. That was my co-host from Fedora Reloaded, Skrillit. I might as well introduce everyone now. So this is Klaatu. Here's Skrillit from Fedora Reloaded.
Where the internet masses.
And we've got ZigFlup from Demo or Bust.
Oh, hi.
And we have, of course, Deep Geek from Talk and Geek to Me and Hacker Public Radio.
Hey, what's up, guys?
So, Deep Geek, this was actually your idea. This was, you did on Talk Geek to Me, you did a planet.
Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Thank you. Plan 9 from Outer Space review, which was quite funny. It was a really funny review because of the funny movie stuff. The idea of doing one for Forbidden Planet, which, in my humble opinion, is not such a funny movie. A really cool movie, and I guess everyone here has seen it now, correct?
Yeah,
I watched it maybe a couple of weeks ago, to be honest with you, but yeah,
cool.
Same here.
Great. What did everyone think about Forbidden Planet? Actually, do you know a little bit of the history of the movie? Can you give us a little bit of background on it?
Well, as far as the history is going, I'm not sure I'm the best historian in the world, but it was 1950, the 1950s, right, Klaatu?
Yeah.
And it stars Leslie Nielsen and actually a serious role.
Right.
And
1956, I believe.
56.
56, okay.
Anne Francis as the leading woman, and actually Leslie Nielsen makes a really good leading man in it, and it's got the first appearance of the infamous Robbie the Robot, and it's just so well done. I mean, I can't believe I can watch a 1956 movie here in 2009 and still think that this thing is just seems so up to date. You know what I mean? I mean, it's, you know, it's still, I mean...
Yeah, it feels like it was made yesterday. Well, maybe not yesterday, but it feels like it was made maybe 5 years ago or something like that.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, just the scenery and everything in it is just amazing, and it seems to break all the rules, and then you begin seeing things that, you know, like the original Star Trek stole from them, and there's all this boring that went along, and then, of course, you know, the main prop, Robbie the Robot, went on and had his own career in film, which is pretty good for something that's not even human. And
what else was he in? You said that he made like a guest appearance on Lost in Space, right? But he wasn't the robot in Lost in Space.
No, that's right. And he keeps getting confused with the robot in Lost in Space. And basically, Lost in Space, when I looked into it, because I actually had an argument with a Trekkie over dinner about this, and I actually had to dive into the internet and prove my point. And
very classy, mind you.
Yeah.
And the robot from Lost in Space was actually designed by the same guy, but it was a less expensive design than Robbie. And it's actually the name of it is B9, which even I was just amazed the other day because I was just listening to a podcast called Cap Admiral's Table, and they were interviewing George Robb, who does a geologic podcast, and he was talking about the Star Trek movies and found out that Data's backup copy was B4. And so I caught the reference right away. I didn't think they'd caught it. You know, B9 actually, you know, had to be cheaper because they actually had to have a stunt double. And he couldn't use legs because Robbie the Robot almost fell over and cracked in half while filming Forbidden Planet. So it was just too expensive for the time.
It's interesting that you say this is designed by the same guy. I don't know, like, would it stand to argue that a lot of the 1950s robot stereotypes possibly comes from one guy?
Well, it's interesting that their build has similarities, because Robbie's known for his two different twirling ears, and B9 had that, although they were glass encased, and they both had the kind of chest area that flashed with neon lights every time they made a syllable, and they both had arms that were disjointed in some way, and then it ends with Robbie having this bulbous shaped thing for legs, and B9 not having legs, and you know what's the other? But I mean, the similarity also is the fact that they both have the torsos of washing machines, because the guy who designed them was a washing machine engineer, so they have that big tubular shape. about them. So
yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think Sikva has a point. It seems like a lot of the sort of the stereotypes from those kind of 50s and 60s movies of what robots would look like kind of stem from that, or perhaps some other notion from which Robbie the Robot also stemmed. But yeah, there's definite similarities there, I think.
Didn't you go to like a robot exhibition at a museum or something? That must have been cool.
Yeah, I did, but it wasn't really all that cool because everything was running XP, and it just wasn't as cool as I hoped for. But yeah, they displayed the original Robbie robot statue. Ooh, or nice. Something. Yeah, so that was kind of fun. And the Gort, of course, the Gort statue. But that's a different movie.
Well, Gort wasn't really a separate prop, was he, Klaatu? Gort was a costume. He wasn't really...
That's correct, yeah.
I was kind of disappointed. Kind of getting maybe a bit away from the robots and a little bit more into the plot of the movie. That, what was her name? Altera, I believe?
Yeah, Altera was her like, girl's name.
Yeah. Okay, so I watched this movie when I was a kid, right? I remember being bored as hell and not watching it. So this is like the first time I've actually watched it and paid attention to the plot. And I was kind of disappointed that I thought that she was the source of all this stuff.
Oh, like, funny.
Yeah, I thought that would be like a twist that would come up, and it turns out it wasn't.
I definitely had. I remember thinking the same thing. I thought it was probably, yeah, I thought it was possibly one of the, you know, either the robot or the girl. You know, I just, because the guy was so protective of Altera, so I kind of thought, interesting. And then the robot was just such a potential threat throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, but eventually the robot, Robbie gets alibied by the ship's, the ship's chef, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Getting stuck with the ship's chef.
Well, I mean, talking about the plot now, the plot, from what I understand, is stolen right out of Shakespeare.
Oh, really?
Isn't everything? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy wrote, like, all the common themes, so... But, I've never read... I forget which play they say it's ripped off from. I think it's, like, The Twelfth Night or something.
Yeah, it's a play that involves a guy who's punished, so he's intentionally shipwrecked on a planet with his daughter, and everyone ignores him for, like, decades, and they come to him and find out he's got all this stuff going on, and... You know, so it's that. But I guess it's a cheap shot to rip off William Shakespeare, huh?
I think it's a broad statement to say that something is like a Shakespearean play. You know, I mean, it's just like.
But Walter Pidgeon has that mad scientist kind of suppressed evil thing down, doesn't he?
He does. He did it well. That's for sure.
I mean, before this movie, my experience with Walter Pidgeon was in Harry in Your Pocket. Have you guys ever heard of this movie?
No.
This was a weird 60s kind of romanticizing crime movie about a band of pickpockets traveling across Vancouver, Canada. And Walter Pidgeon is like the eldest and teaching them all how to expertly rip people off, and they're hitting up dog shows and stuff. It's got James Coburn in it. It's really good. So that's where I knew him from, and I'm like, oh, he did sci-fi, too.
Yeah, well, I just think, like, the whole idea of being able to put, like unlimited energy behind your thoughts is, like, the most amazing idea, like, right there.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. I never really thought of that, but that is what was going on, obviously, and that's kind of a unique idea. I don't know if that's...
It's the only time I've ever seen it in a movie. It's amazing. And I'd seen that movie before, like, I don't remember when, and I didn't even remember that. And then when I watched it a couple weeks ago, I was like, oh my gosh, that's right. Look at that. For 1950. Yeah.
Well, Klaatu, you got to remember to put in a spoiler alert in the beginning of this thing when you begin chopping it up, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point.
But, I mean, I'm amazed at how they led up to it, because they led up to it so slowly. I mean, first it's like, come, have a look at their technology, and he goes through this weird-shaped door and says he didn't know what they looked like, or they only had the shape of this door to guess.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they begin doing things with this brain meter, and then he shows them the power plant, and you begin wondering why they have these huge submerged nuclear power fusion things going on under the planet. And then, you know, all of a sudden you find out that they're going to, you know, impose their will by sheer thought, and the machine was going to create things out there. And it was just, the lead up was so amazing. And one of the matte paintings was like a power plant, too,
yeah,
wasn't
the matte
it?
Painting.
Yeah,
that was beautiful stuff.
Wild.
It was incredible.
I would love that.
Oh, yeah, me too. That's one of the things that really sticks in my mind whenever I think of that movie, is that one shot where they're crossing that bridge over to, I think, the brain meter part of the station. And you just see this, thing reaching deep into the planet core, you know, just generating all this power. It was just, that was really cool.
Yeah, and they're talking about it's like 75,000 floors or something. And
yeah, yeah.
6 miles wide is the dimensions.
Yeah.
And looking at these matte paintings, and you see these dwarfed little people talking about this, and you're like, it looks that way, too.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, another visual thing that really, really impressed me, I'm a fan of Japanese anime. I don't know if any of you guys are.
Sure.
But the scene where the monster is first shot at with laser beams, and it's an animated special effect, that scene
right. Is
just, it is not cell animation. It is, they did some weird thing with double exposed negatives that they animated hand drawings, and then they colored it, and you know, you just have this thing, this outline of this invisible being that's rearing and roaring and throwing people around, and you just see this outline and just the tracers of the laser beams. It's just amazing.
I don't know exactly what technique they used, that they perhaps drew onto the negatives or something, the light or something like that. But what do you think they used exactly for that deep geek?
Well, I understand they did ink and pen drawings, and then photographed them frame by frame.
Ah.
And then there was the negative. They had to take negatives of that so they could color it. So I mean, you know, that's the funny thing about this movie, is that it looks so visually stunning, and you know somehow they aren't using CGI. They're using all these pre-CGI techniques like animation and special photography. And it still looks good. It still looks futuristic.
Yeah, that blew me away when I saw the visuals. I mean, I just thought, I don't understand how this was made in the 50s, but it looks so, not only, like, technically, you know, proficient, but also just so stunning in terms of what they were trying to achieve. Like, they were really kind of being visually daring, I think. I don't know of any other science fiction film before that tried to really imagine the fantastic stuff that they were trying to imagine, other than maybe Metropolis.
What were the other movies that were around during this time? I think I went on the IMDb, and I was trying to figure out how to search for genre and date, and I couldn't figure it out. But I know at least Frankenstein. Wasn't that like 1959 or 1960 or something like that? Do we know of any other sci-fi movies around this time?
Klaatu, when did the one you got your handle from come out?
I should know that off the top of my head.
Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Wasn't that, I'm thinking 51 off the top of my head.
You could be right. I think 54. And that was cool, but I mean, again, just nowhere near in terms of, like, daring visuals, I don't think. Like, with this house.
Well, we've been talking about visual for some time, but I mean, I'm thinking about the first part, the first thing I saw that really just surprised me, the thing that said, I said, ooh, that's different. So, I mean, you guys, what do you guys think? What was the first scene in this movie that you said, that's not like other science fiction movies?
Well, for myself, the kind of watching the two-thirds of it where the plot begins to reveal itself, I think the plot itself is very new as far as concepts are concerned. Like, there's this planet that has machines that's makes things based on what you think, that seems to me like a very modern concept, and not necessarily something that was prevalent in movies in the 50s.
And the lack of that sort of communist undertone that was very prevalent in all those films back then, you know, it was like, they just seemed to really step outside of the planet Earth and just do something completely foreign. And there weren't any big undertones of, oh, look how bad the Russians are, or, like, look, it's the Germans except on another planet. You know, it was completely separate, it seemed.
Yeah, it's just like, this is a human being, and what if this was possible?
Yeah.
What really amazed me initially, the first three, let me give you three things that really stand my mind. And maybe they're worthy of further exploration. The first thing was nearly every science fiction movie I've ever seen in my life, they all have a corny insignia on their breast. And their uniforms did not in this movie, which I really appreciated after this many science fiction movies. The second thing that really stood out was when they're jumping down from hyperspace, they go into almost this thing that you could tell they stole the Star Trek transporter from, where they're all standing on these little pads, this beam comes down and covers them to keep them safe while they decelerate.
Oh my goodness, was this the first transporter?
It wasn't a transporter, it was like something to keep their bodies from flying up against the wall or something.
Yeah.
And the third thing I noticed was that, for a change, we're the ones coming out of the UFO, the flying saucer.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I noticed that myself, too. I don't know, how popular do you think it was for... I got the impression that us flying in flying saucers is a bit more popular back before. Sort of in the 50s and the 60s, when this whole UFO sighting thing was new. I think that was a lot more prevalent in movies.
The UFO sighting thing was never new. That's like saying podcasting is new, but people have always passed around weird recordings of themselves talking, and so you can't really say it's new. And I'm not going to get into all UFOlogy, because I'd probably bore you guys to death. But if you ever listen to anything about UFOs, and you say instead of flying saucer and grays, you replaced balls of light and angels, the statement still makes sense. So there's something that happens somewhere in the 20th century where the space theme comes into it, and we're no longer talking like in Bible symbols, we're now talking in space symbols. So, I mean, the idea of space aliens and stuff just never was new, or flying saucers was new. It was like an assignment for something that's already happening, or has always happened to people in different states.
Okay.
Specifically, us as in aliens? I mean, us as in aliens, sorry. Us as in humans? Or you mean just the concept of a people in flying saucers?
Yeah, I'm saying the latter. The concept of people coming from flying saucers, like we were talking a little bit about Lost in Space and the ship that they used.
Ah, the Jupiter, right? Saucer.
Yeah, Jupiter or something like that. That's a bloody flying saucer. It seems to me like a lot of these vehicles in movies of that time were flying saucers.
The funny thing is the sense of scale at different movies. It's like the one I made fun of, Planet 9 from Outer Space. You can tell the flying saucers are like hand puppets or something, you know? And then you compare, you know, you think about where Day of the Earth Stood Still did a really good job was when the flying saucer lands on the mall in Washington, D.C. And if you've ever been to the mall in Washington, D.C., you know there's no baseball fields, but they've actually put four baseball fields to show this thing covering, so you know it's big, you know? And that's something they don't really do. I mean, you have some light vehicles rolling around underneath this thing in Forbidden Planet, but it's not the same, you know. The scales are all weird in different movies, is what I'm saying. I'd like to talk about the role of woman in this movie.
I was about to mention the same thing.
All right.
Well, no, because they make references to Robbie in female contexts that are interesting.
All right.
The way he was like, he was a housekeeper.
Well, yeah. I mean, I hate to sound sexist, but it was very obvious to me in the beginning when Robbie pulls up and introduces himself, and then, you know, the cook says, "Is it a guy or a woman?" And Robbie says, "That's meaningless for me, sir." But then he says, "Strap in, guys," and then, you know, when they get into the car to go back to the base, and the one guy says, "Wow, it sure acts like our mother." And then Robbie is doing housekeeping later on. And I picked up this sexist vibe from my 2009 perspective.
Right. Well, yeah, given the perspective, the time period that they're making it, I would imagine so, yeah.
Yeah, and
kind of caught me off guard, to be honest with you, when they asked what gender Robbie was. Like, I wasn't even thinking that. Why would this be like a robot?
Well, it's even weird because, I mean, I love a genre of science fiction called cyberpunk, and the first big novel is Neuromancer. And Neuromancer involves these two artificial intelligences in cyberspace, and one is pursuing each other and they're trying to complete each other. And so one takes on the role of pursuer, which eventually realizes a male aspect, and the other takes on this passive and yet creative aspect. You know, and this thing rolls together toward the end of Neuromancer, you know, as the plot resolves, and you realize that, you know, hey, have I ever read a science fiction movie where two programs had gender relations? I don't think so. You know, so, I mean, I think maybe I was well prepared somehow to pick up on this stuff.
When do you think that this engendrement of these genderless things, of robots and computer programs, started? Was before cyberpunk? Do you think this existed before cyberpunk?
Well, I think this is maybe one of the first few ones we've ever seen with Robbie, you know, having these housekeeper and these traditional 50s wifely aspects to him. I don't remember anything before in any other science fiction I've ever seen. What about you guys?
Back in the 20s, one of the sci-fi movies featured, you know, the very famous female robot, Maria.
What was the name of that one?
Metropolis.
Metropolis! I always wanted to see that.
Finding a good transfer of that movie is really hard. I'm very picky about my old, you know, transfers. A lot of people don't realize that the old movies were always, you know, since they didn't have to sync sound, they were like 18 frames per second, and yet people always transfer them to something higher, like 24, so it looks sped up. Nothing negatives at all, you know, it just looks really bad. I mean, they're old, so they're going to look bad, but, I mean, in terms of quality, but still. So finding a good copy is really hard, but you could certainly find Metropolis, I'm sure, like on archive.org if you just haven't seen it before.
To be honest with you, I haven't. That was the 1920s. This robot, I think, was very feminized as far as what was perceived as being feminized. You know what I mean? Like, the shape of the robot is almost sexy. You know what I mean? Like,
which robot's almost sexy?
Metropolis.
Oh, yes, yes. The physique you must be referring to is etched into the minds of film lovers everywhere, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
You know who who must have been the most strong female cyborg figure has to come from Japanese anime, Major Kusanagi.
And who is this?
This was the female cop in the partnership between her character and the character, Batu. In Ghost in the Shell. And that's also very, very interesting because, you know, the creature that comes out of the internet gives her this speech about selection going. We have to be one, baby. You know, he really comes on to her in a strong way at the end of that movie. It's really amazing. Yeah, and so in Ghost in the Shell, but I mean the character, I mean it's very hard to imagine because the cyborgs look so human, except for that they move stiff. And it's hard to remember that the only thing biological left in this Major Kusanagi character is maybe a few pounds of brain matter, and everything else is, you know, 25th century robotics.
Oh, cool. Do you think it's, do you think it's more common for, this character in Ghost in the Shell is, a girl, and Robbie the Robot is feminized, at least that's what the characters say, and, do you think it's common that robots and these inanimate things tend to be girls more than boys? Or do you think it's 50-50?
As far as science fiction in general goes?
Yeah, as far as science fiction.
No, I think it's even. I mean, if we look at the almost exclusively male robots of, like, the Star Wars, at least the first Star Wars movie they made, and then I think in other Star Wars movies they had robot soldiers all over the place. And I don't think you could call those feminized characters.
Okay.
Well, I mean, C-3PO has often been accused of being, you know, homosexual or homoerotic or something.
C-3PO is the first homoerotic robot?
Really?
That's what I've heard.
I've never heard that.
Anything, I'm just saying.
I just thought he was trying to pretend he was some kind of butler, actually.
And Hal as well. I mean, he's got that infinite... quote, a feminine voice, you know.
Hal, the murderous computer in the spaceship, is feminine?
You've not heard this? I'm like, look, someone needs to do, like, a thesis paper on, you know, gender roles in robotics in sci-fi movies.
Sure.
Yeah, so that is...
Yeah, well, you know, I guess because Hal is, they're basically inside of Hal, right? And he's taking care of their physical needs. There's like an embryo relationship, isn't there?
And they're asleep. I mean, some of them are literally in cryostasis or whatever, so,
Well, we better stop before we talk about Hal killing the sleeping ones as being some kind of symbolic, I won't even finish the sentence. You're all gone already.
But the one thing that got me about Back to the Actual Topic, Man's Forbidden Planet, and, like, the quote-unquote gender roles or whatever, is that there's that kind of pursuit thing going on, you know, it's like one guy from the crew has the hots for the girl, and then the captain has the hots for the girl.
Oh, I disagree.
Sort of that little disagree, you know, that sort of, what is it, like that playful banter between, you know, and there's that whole sort of, like, competing men for the woman kind of thing, which just, I don't know, it's probably realistic, but it just tends to annoy me.
Well,
yeah, it annoys me too.
and Francis is this
movie I did not like.
Yeah.
Why? Why does it annoy you guys? Well, I mostly date women, right? So, like, there's a lot of straight romantic subplot in movies, and it's just played out so often, and it's so stereotypical, and it's done over and over again in pretty much every movie, that it just annoys me.
Why does it have to be that way? I mean, I'm sure that it's great for the guy to pursue the girl and stuff like that, and very, like I said, it's probably very realistic, but does it have to be always that assumption that these guys are going to go after this girl and end up with that male-dominated, like, pursuit of romance? Although,
yeah, that's a good point, kind of like steep on itself.
Yeah.
Like, if it isn't happening, well then, look, it's happening, so...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's a really good point.
But it is funny, because Altera has sort of that kind of inexperienced brashness that really throws them for a loop, right? I mean, she'll say things like, what, I was just trying to, you know, I was just having a little fun with kissing, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure in the 50s was just sort of complete,
people writing the newspaper and freaking out.
Yeah, you know, I can just imagine people just saying, you know, I can't believe she would just kiss these people just so, you know, and she was swimming naked in that one scene. I mean, she had a bodysuit on for the filming, of course, but I mean, you know, the suggestiveness, I think, at least for that time period, always kind of threw me off as well.
Well, Altera's character, played by Anne France, I think she did a really good job.
She did a great job.
At pulling off this uber virginal character, and I mean, I should hope so, because I would think that for the time period we're discussing, I would think the potentiality of the audiences being able to handle a concept such as incest, since there's only one male and female on that planet before the spaceship shows up, would be so outweighed anything else that they would have to have Altera be uber inexperienced, since there could be only one source of experience for her if she wasn't uber inexperienced. What do you guys think?
I kind of lost track of all the experience.
Yeah, I lost track.
I must be rambling horrible.
I just got confused. But I think what you're saying is that she doesn't have any real world experience, so she just knows that probably her thoughts of women and men get together, you know. And but to her, it's almost like it's almost like breeding plants or something. That's how she treats it.
Right.
It's not, there's none of that sort of cultural kind of like imposed dating ritual thing that she knows. So when she comes on too strong to one of the guys or something, it really upsets their sensibility.
Since these humans are on this other planet, it turns them into an alien race. Mm. Like, without any experience. Like, they're biologically human, but they're acting completely foreign and different in every way.
How so?
Well, I mean, with no experience and, like, no reference at all, and no way to, I mean, they make her more alien-esque. There's no society to affect her, so her mind is completely different. And interesting.
Do you suppose that Altera was generated by these machines because of Morbius's idea of her, or do you think Altera is an actual biological human? I don't know if they made reference to this or not.
Actually, Siegflub, this is very interesting, because I never thought of this possibility, because he actually says that she is the daughter of her and another traveler from the original ship, but why, since they have this technology that takes thought, more thought, and creates things out of it, why couldn't he have some kind of fantasy of a wife on the first ship coming over and have the actual technology create Altera? That's actually possible.
I think they kind of alluded to maybe when he was when Morbius is in the room with the brain reader, as Klaatu put it, and he puts on this device, right? And there's a little like hologram.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I think he to throw up a fan site for the movie on some, you know, GeoCities or something.
GeoCities is closed as of Monday.
Yeah, GeoCities is gone, dude.
Oh, all those bad websites. The random pop cultural icons gone.
Oh, there's some interesting things. Actually, have you guys heard about Jason Scott?
Oh, yeah. He's coming up. I'm doing a demo or bust. I recorded an interview with him. I'm doing three people in this one episode, so I haven't put it together yet. But, I know of him.
Jason Scott, I mean, I follow his blog, and he actually got laid off a couple of months ago from his day job.
Yeah.
And he finally went on his blog and said, look, I want to take a sabbatical. And so I saw this thing on Kickstarter, and if you want to fund, make a pledge to my sabbatical, and if it comes off, I'll do it. I'll just sit down and do computer history and research for 3 months straight and finish my documentary. Get Lamp, and I was like, well, yeah, you know, I ran right in there and pledged right away.
That's pretty cool.
it probably sounds really blushing of me, but I mean, you know, I told you guys before, at least before we started recording, that I have this real anti-corporate streak, and, you know, the idea of actually someone, his patrons just being regular people, just really got stuck in my craw, and I was like, oh yeah, the only other thing I was a patron of before was my library, you know?
Well, not having McDonald's sponsoring him means that all throughout his next documentary film, there won't be, like, McDonald's cups, you know, prominently featured in all the shots.
Wayne, are you being completely facetious here? Was he...
Just a little. you know, we spent so much time on female gender issues, and I don't think I was as sensitive, perhaps, as I should have been. Are there any male gender issues we have to look at?
I think we've already discussed them. I mean, the whole thing about the pursuit, you know, the whole competing male thing bugs me. And then there's the issue as well, for at least for me, is that whole structure of the whole, it's the given structure of there's this captain and there's these commanders and there's this punishment if you do anything wrong, like, you know, drink or something, you know, I mean, it's just like so militaristic. I don't know if that's necessarily a male issue or a military issue, but...
It seems fairly masculine to me, too.
It's just kind of like, I don't know, we're in the future now, do we have to necessarily bring all that stuff with us? I mean, we did such a good job of imagining everything else completely differently, but there are certain things that they just couldn't quite be revolutionary about, I guess.
Yeah, well, I guess it's been like 5 years since the first World War II, so sometimes they can get out of their head.
Yeah.
That seemed pretty overwhelming.
Granted, but, I mean, that whole militaristic mindset didn't start with World War II. It's almost a culmination of World War II. You know, that mindset has been around for a long time. So it almost seems like it might have been more daring. I mean, the fact that I can complain about this, of all things, I mean, it just shows how great the movie is. But, I mean, of all things, to try to reinvent, maybe that would have been one of them that they could have tried. I think it would have been cool. Interesting to see, you know, how things might work, I don't know, with a little less authority.
I don't think it's a macho thing as much as it's, you know, I mean, if you made a real science fiction, I mean, you know, you talk about universe creation, and I think that if you create a universe that is truly incredibly radical, I mean, that people would not be able to even comprehend the movie if there was just no point of reference. And I think perhaps for a society in the 50s, maybe the military stuff was the reference they left there to build a framework for everything else.
Yeah, I mean, I get that you do have to have a little bit of like stuff that we can latch on to in order for us, the mere audience, to understand what's going on. But
how is it taken in the? Do you guys know how this movie was originally taken from a 1950s audience? Like
I always thought it was pretty popular. I mean, it certainly seems like Lost in Space was the direct descendant of this, and that was a really popular show. And I guess if you're popular enough to have essentially a spin-off, then you must be doing well. Well, and Robbie the Robot did become one, like Tinky says. I mean, he was kind of a, like, things with star Robbie Robot, you know? I mean, that's what people view that character as if though he was an actor, you know?
One thing I heard of is that Steven Spielberg was being interviewed about this someplace, and he was talking about how it was common for boys at the time to have a fantasy after seeing this movie about having a robot as a protector. And, you know, like you said, Klaatu, that seems to certainly be taken over by Will Robinson and B9 later in the Lost in Space series.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that always really, really interested me was the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, that spacey...
Very good impression.
Oh, I'm glad you're impressed.
I thought we were watching the movie.
I thought we were watching
the movie. Right now.
Yeah, it's like all... It's not even a theremin. It's like just electronically generated tones. I don't know exactly what they used, but you can hear stuff sort of around that kind of feel from, like, Pauline Oliveros. She's an experimental artist from around the same time. And this was Luis and Bebe Baron, and they did... apparently the first, you know, all electronic score. And I just love it because it's half the time you're hearing it and you're like, well, is this the score that I'm hearing or is this the sound effects?
It's amazing because it sounds like they got some people to do these sound effects with these oscilloscopes and stuff, and then they said, you know what, let's fire the band.
Yeah, really.
You know, it's like they liked it so much they fired the band, and because you never hear a regular instrument in the whole movie. You just hear the sound effects, and you just hear the weird squeals. But yet it is musical. It's the tonality. I mean, is it melodic?
In some parts, I think it's almost melodic.
You know, I think there was this really good experimental band that was very much inspired by the soundtrack of this very movie. I think they were called, hold on, let me just check my computer.
Okay.
Yeah, it was Fat Chance Lester, wasn't it?
That's very funny.
I have to watch this again. I didn't even take note of the soundtrack. So,
well, like I said, just thought it was like literally, it's not a soundtrack. It's like it's not even a soundscape. I mean, it's just something, it's a tonal impression of the future. I mean, it's bizarre.
Yeah, it's affecting your mind.
Yes.
So, how did you guys watch this movie? Did you download it with BitTorrent? Did you find it on YouTube? May I ask, Clitu, how did you find this movie? Or watch it better?
I was born knowing about this movie. I don't remember when I first saw this movie. It's one of those that I've seen, do you want me to just start quoting all the lines from the beginning?
No. How did you watch it, now, for this episode of HBO?
I know everything by heart. I didn't have to watch it again.
I see what you're saying.
I do have it ripped to a hard drive, though. I mean, it was...
Okay.
Well, I came across it kind of oddly accidental, because when I did Plan 9 from Outer Space, which looked geek to me, the idea of a series is to have a bunch of bad sci-fi movies reviewed. And I think I got to get a copy of Teens from Outer Space next for that one. But so I began. I remembered something.
MST3K.
Yeah, it's like a cheap ripoff of MST3K. That was like, I remember there was some movie that had Robbie the Robot dancing to a Lawrence Welk-esque bubble machine. And I began looking for that, and I came across actually this very good movie. And I began, Klaatu's the go-to guy for sci-fi. And I went to him and I said, well, that's you and I, because look at all these weird themes I pulled out of this, and I can't do this alone. And then we went back and forth a few times and we said, well, we can't do this as a pair, and we have to make a round table out of this, right? As far as actually getting the physical copy, I used the best kept secret in America, my library card.
Oh, yeah.
Ah. Yeah, it's perfect for old sci-fi movies. Holy crap.
Yeah, that's great.
And new sci-fi movies. Very good library.
Yeah, really.
I was so disappointed. I went to Mininova and I searched for this movie, and I found a torrent. And I hadn't downloaded anything from BitTorrents in maybe 4 months or so. And it turns out my ISP is not blocking it. So I had to find it on YouTube piece by piece.
Come on, Lynn, what's your name? Oh, who's your ISP?
Comcast.
Boo, his Comcast.
I hate Comcast. What was that?
Yeah, totally.
This girl, how did you see the movie most recently?
I watched it on my laptop from DVD.
You didn't? I thought I put it on FTP for you.
I got it from the library.
Oh.
She knows the library trick.
I wanted a really good quality.
Hey, Scarlett, did you hear about, because you said high quality. We were talking about Jason Scott's next documentary. Did you hear that DVD quality wasn't good enough for him? Yeah, he's like, DVD's not good enough, and I don't want to pay these Blu-ray fees, and he's actually considering releasing it on USB drive. He says the 8 gigabytes he has to do whatever he wants with, without paying for licensing fees, on a DVD, on a USB drive, is beats DVD, and he does that.
Wow.
Yeah.
He wouldn't be the first to do that. I mean, there was a director who released a feature film, Rude, to iPod only back in 2005 or 6.
Yeah, but I have M-Player, which I'm sure will play whatever format that thing came out in, and I just can't find the download.
It's an MPEG 4, and yeah, I don't know why it's not downloadable. It's probably, they probably are screwballs and don't have their website up. So, DeepGeek, when you were originally pitching the idea of talking about Forbidden Planet, you mentioned something about God.
There's the concept of God as the uncreated creator, or the prime mover, they call it sometimes in philosophy. So I mean, Morbius's thought projections can be viewed as playing God, but also playing God has a sarcasm to it about being kingship and making dictatorial decisions, which he tries to do when he says things like, "No, I will not release their technology to the human species because they aren't ready for it, and they'll blow each other up." But I mean, it sure as heck fits with the whole mechanism behind the machine that projects his thoughts from his subconscious and creates them into a real monster running around killing people, not just from the spaceship you're looking at, but historically from the spaceship the original characters came from, that the rescue ship is now encountering. So, yeah.
Well, what about the sort of classic kind of moral story that, you know, if man gets everything that he wants, you know, he'll eventually be ruined, you know? I mean, because this guy is getting basically anything he can think of, I guess. And it's his, like, what does he say? Like, it's my id at the door. It's my evil self at the door, and I can't stop it, or something like that. You know, it's like kind of like his bad thoughts are kind of doing him in. Outside of that,
can't stop it.
We all have this animal, this aggressive animal, from our survival instincts left over, you know, underneath our. The part of our brain that does this responsible for just pure cranking out pure rational thoughts. There's this survival thing that can certainly kick in at any time, and usually when you have big violent actions in between individuals, that's what happened. Is something triggered that, and the response is either I gotta get out of here or I gotta kill something that's in here with me. So I mean,
yeah.
But with Morbius, it's more of a protecting his family thing that triggers it, where he's got to keep Altera, you know, away from going back to the Earth, and then his subconscious thing projects this monster that's trying to kill a spaceship, which is an obvious transportation mechanism that could take her away from him.
Unless you subscribe to Sigfrid's theory about Altera being a creation of Morbius, in which case he's not protecting his family, he's protecting...
But
you can draw from extension from that. I mean, if Morbius has this fantasy family, he might as well protect that as any other family.
If it's created as a subconscious urge in Morbius, that if he doesn't acknowledge to himself that Altera might be his own creation, then he wouldn't know that he wasn't protecting a figment of his imagination made real. He would protect it as if it were.
I think he would know. He lied to them about her origin, and he's just selfishly protecting his little perfect world that he's created for himself.
But wouldn't that perfect world still include a spouse instead of a daughter?
Yeah, well, you'd think so, and that unlocks a whole Freudian mess that we don't want to delve into, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I like the idea of movies that ask questions like, I mean, is Morbius right in wanting to protect humanity from that power? I mean, could humanity handle it or not? Like,
when we enter the movie, we find Morbius discovering this race that blew their brains out on some technology, and there's your answer right there. But Morbius's blind spot is that he doesn't realize that he is caught up in the process of having his world destroyed by the same technology, I think. No?
I agree. You say, Clatu, that maybe Morbius is lying and he's aware of what he's doing. He seemed pretty surprised.
He really does, especially when he tells his robot that he created mechanically, you know, gives him the conflicting order to destroy that thing out there, and the robot knows, you know, you just asked me to destroy you, and shorts out.
No, see, because he can still be aware of him wanting to protect his own little perfect bubble and still be blindsided by the fact that he's caught up in, you know, he's like addicted to a reality that's just doomed to fail.
Well, do you guys think we have enough for a wrap on this episode?
Yeah, I think so.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.